This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything that Rich, Tom and I have been up to on what's been quite a data-tastic Thursday morning. That's because we've got preliminary numbers out for GDP when it comes to both the UAE and Sharjah. We've been getting the economist Ed Bell's take on those. And also an upgraded forecast from Emirates NBD when it comes to the UAE non-oil economy for this year. We've also been having a look at the bank that everyone was talking about last year because of its savings rates. WEO Bank has just finished its first year of operations and it's profitable. Jayesh Patel is the CEO. Speaking of numbers, great set of numbers coming out from NVIDIA, the AI chip people. We've been speaking to an analyst from eToro about that. And with news that the boss of the World Economic Forum is about to move aside, we've been looking at who might come next. Frederick Secret is the former managing director of the World Economic Forum. He's been speaking to Richard about who might be on the shortlist.
Let's jump into the numbers right here on the Business Breakfast. We are getting numbers left, right and centre, local, regional and international. Ed Bell has been put to task to try and make sense of these. We start in the UAE first, Richard Dean. We've got some GDP numbers coming through.
Yeah, we have. Yes, we've got UAE GDP numbers and we've got Sharjah numbers. Actually, Brandy's been crunching these numbers yesterday, weren't you, Brandy? I know you wrote the headlines on these. So the UAE number, I think you described it as, is it preliminary?
It is preliminary. It's a stealth number. It popped up on a government website. 3.6% GDP growth for 2023. The big surprise, actually, is the non-oil sector growth, which was up just over 6%. Emirates NBD has been looking at the numbers, comparing them to their own forecasts. This is Ed Bell.
The UAE's economy grew by 3.6% in 2023, and that was bang on in line with our forecast, according to some preliminary data that was published earlier this week. The non-oil sector expanded by a bit more than 6% last year, while the oil and gas sector actually contracted. Financial services was the fastest growing sector last year, expanding by more than 14% after 6.6% growth in 2022. After that, it was transport and logistics, which was up more than 11%, followed by construction and real estate services as being the big drivers of growth last year.
We've also got a printout from Sharjah in the last 24 hours, 6.5% growth for 2023, and quite the uptick in non-oil revenue as well. That's come out from the Department of Statistics and Community Development in Sharjah, which has a very fetching mint green logo. Hadn't seen it before. So we've asked Ed to put those numbers in context for us and what it says about what we might see in the UAE this year.
At an Emirate level, the Abu Dhabi non-oil economy grew by more than 9% last year, with financial services, logistics, construction, wholesale, retail trade, all adding substantially to growth. For Dubai, we've seen only data for the first three quarters of the year, which showed the economy expanding by 3.3%, with many of the similar drivers like transport, logistics, all helping to support the Emirates economy. I think the data that we're seeing has shown that the UAE's economy has been very resilient to both a lackluster external backdrop as well as substantially higher interest rates last year. For 2024, we're only expecting a modest easing in monetary policy from the Fed, and that's going to be in the second half of this year, just 50 basis points of rate cuts. That is likely going to weigh on private sector investment. But we do expect to see the public sector investing heavily in things like transport and other infrastructure to remain robust this year and beyond. We'll have projects like the Etihad Rail Network and the Al Maktoum Airport. All of that is going to help to underpin non-oil GDP growth, offsetting any moderation in the private sector investment or household consumption.
Yeah, Emirates NBD actually has just upgraded its non-oil outlook for the UAE this year. Ed told us a bit more about that.
So we've updated our non-oil growth forecast for the UAE this year to 5% from 4.5% previously, and that's going to take headline GDP growth to 3.7%, and that's up from 3.3% previously. For now, we're not assuming any growth in the oil and gas sector as the UAE is still participating in the OPEC Plus production cuts, but there could be a risk to the upside if the targeted level for the UAE is increased at an OPEC meeting later in June. So that could add a little bit of upside risk to our headline GDP forecast.
Right, upside risk would be good. All eyes, of course, on that OPEC meeting that we've got. I think it's the 1st of June. The question being, are some of those cuts going to be extended into Q3?
So that's Ed on the UAE, but he's been earning his lunch today because we've asked him also to look over to the UK. Is that right?
We have indeed, yes. And to get us in the mood to talk about the UK, because it is politics and economics, can we have a bit of Ed Sheeran and Stormzy, Tom?
Oh, sure. So take me back to London.
Take me back to London. Okay. There we go. Now I'm in the mood. We've got an election. Serena mentioned this in her headlines as well. It's happening on the 4th of July. But what about the economy? We're the Business Breakfast. This is what we look at. We had the IMF report out earlier on this week. So that gives us a bit of a reading of the health or otherwise of the UK economy as we head into that vote. This is Ed's take.
Overall, the near term in the UK looks fairly decent, and actually indicators like PMIs that we've had so far in 2024 have been fairly healthy. But for a longer term profile, the IMF did note that productivity levels in the UK are relatively low compared to some other peer economies, and so that does present a drag to growth.
UK economy. It's a bit meh, but not awful.
I like that. I like a bit meh.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Talking all things artificial intelligence, in particular the chip maker NVIDIA now. Josh Gilbert, market analyst at eToro, joins us live. Morning, Josh.
Good morning, Richard.
So, earnings and revenue from NVIDIA were absolutely spectacular last night. Talk us through the numbers.
Yeah, they just keep delivering, especially when we had such expectations so high coming in. You know, that makes it really, really tough every time for them. But, you know, that they just keep sort of doing it. They're taking full advantage of this, you know, AI boom. As you said, revenue and earnings well above forecast, upgrading its guidance into the second quarter. Essentially, what we're seeing, Richard, is that they have so much demand for their products at the moment that it's just outstripping supply. You know, they're really stepping up manufacturing to sort of try and deliver that, and that's why investors are sort of ultimately so bullish. But what we're seeing here is a technology revolution that is making NVIDIA a lot of cash.
So the share's up 6% in after hours trading. When the regular session begins today, it will be more than $1,000 a share, and we know that it has risen exponentially over the past couple of years. And yet the market seems bullish that this valuation is justified, what a $2.5 trillion company, and that there's further to go. I was looking on eToro, actually, your website this morning, 32 analysts you guys track, and 98% of them have a buy or strong buy recommendation at NVIDIA. They think we have not missed the train on this one. What's your view?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, you have to agree. I think it's really hard not to be positive because it feels like, you know, this AI party is sort of just getting started. This is, you know, arguably the biggest tech revolution that we've seen in decades. It is changing every part of the world, whether it's our jobs, whether it's, you know, anything we do day to day, AI is becoming a part of that. And it's not just rewarding its own shareholders, it's driving the S&P 500. It's, you know, one of the main profit drivers. You know, if we look at the Magnificent Seven, single-handedly driving earnings growth this quarter as well. As you say, valuation question marks, you know, do come into place, but there is no denying the growth that NVIDIA continue to deliver. And that's the point, I think, is that they keep delivering every single quarter. You know, that they're not sort of missing a beat at all. They keep, you know, beating expectations that are already high and then upgrading those expectations from there as well. Look, I think when you're at the top, which NVIDIA is right now, there is unfortunately only one place you can go, and that is being knocked off that top spot. You have to really stay on top of your game. More competition is sort of going to come in here, but for the time being, they're delivering, you know, in every single segment of the business.
Looking at the commentary from the bosses, Jensen Huang, the CEO and founder, but also the finance chief, Colette Kress, talking about the business case for AI, because that's one of the questions that's been asked, a lot of hype over AI, but are the end users of these chips, Microsoft, Google, Oracle, are they actually making any money? And And Colette said, yes, they are. And she had some stats. She said, if you spend a dollar on NVIDIA chips today, you're going to earn $5 over the next 5 years just renting out that space. And that's essentially what Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure does. But with the next generation of chips out later this year, Blackwell, they're going to work with Facebook's Llama AI model. And Colette Kress said, if you spend a dollar on one of those chips, you're going to earn $7 over the next 4 years just renting it out. That's good money, isn't it? You're not going to get that with a Sydney apartment, are you?
No, exactly that. I think, look, bottom line here is that we are seeing, you know, these big tech names, you mentioned a few, and they're increasing their capital expenditures on AI, right? Because ultimately, any spending on AI at the moment is well placed. If you're not spending on AI, you're essentially being left behind. I think one of the biggest names we can look at is Apple. They haven't been very clear so far on their AI plans. And ultimately, that sort of left them behind against the rest of the Magnificent Seven, you know, over the last sort of 12 months. Playing a bit of catch up now, looking to sort of potentially do a partnership with OpenAI. But for the time being, if, you know, your Amazon, your Microsoft, these big tech names say they're going to be spending on AI, Wall Street is going to applaud that. Because as you say, you know, every dollar they are spending in the future, it's going to be ultimately making them more money. And Microsoft was, you know, the same in their earnings. They essentially said they cannot keep up with demand. They're having to increase their spend to be able to do that. And whose spend does that go to? It goes straight into NVIDIA's pocket. So, you know, everyone seems to be benefiting for the time being, which is obviously fantastic. Companies are making a lot of money, and you can see why. Because, you know, everybody is using it. You know, ChatGPT, we're seeing all of these companies agree partnerships to sort of stay, you know, on top of this revolution, because if you don't, you will get left behind.
I'm going to ask you about the UAE's role in all of this. And that's not because you're an expert on the UAE, you're based in Sydney, Australia, but because you're not. Here in the UAE, we think we're not quite the centre of the AI universe, but we think we've got a big role to play in it. And Jensen Huang was here earlier on this year, and Sam Altman was here a couple of weeks ago from OpenAI. As an outsider looking in, is the UAE even on your radar when it comes to AI?
Yeah, look, I would say so. I think, you know, when we look at the sort of the UAE and what it has done over the last sort of, you know, 5 to 10 years, it has always tried to sort of stay at the forefront of, you know, innovation. Obviously, the country itself is always sort of tried to develop, and no one wants to ultimately get left behind. You know, I think we've seen that with, you know, their sort of positive attitude to sort of crypto assets in sort of years gone by as well. And as you say, there's a lot of interest from, you know, sovereign nations as well to sort of really get involved. There's a big you know, view here, especially when it comes to data and privacy. Nations are sort of, again, not wanting to be left behind. They're wanting to sort of stay up, you know, up to date. And that's, you know, a completely fair point. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see, you know, UAE wanting to sort of become a hub for AI to try and attract talent. You know, we obviously see that is, you know, a big draw card for the UAE, is trying to attract new talent in whatever areas, you know, are seeing that growth. And AI is definitely one of the sectors that are seeing the biggest growth at the moment. So it wouldn't surprise me to see, you know, continued spending in that area.
Last point from me, looking on eToro, 32 analysts, 31 buys, one hold. I'm going to add a sell to that. I'm going to say AMD and Intel will catch up in 2 or 3 years with NVIDIA. So its pricing power will go. And also for consumer electronics, interesting that Microsoft is buying NVIDIA chips for its Azure cloud, but for the Surface AI laptop, they went with Qualcomm chips. So on a consumer level, maybe NVIDIA doesn't have an edge. So that's why I'm going to add a sell recommendation on the eToro website. 30 seconds, your quick take on that.
Yeah, look, I said it earlier, but we're absolutely going to see competition increase, and especially when you're having, you know, so much success from NVIDIA, that they're, you know, people are going to want to sort of come and eat their lunch. But I think for the time being, they're innovating, they're staying at the top of the game, and no one is getting close to them for the time being. So until we see them slip up, you know, I think they're going to continue to sort of keep delivering for now.
Josh, really appreciate your time today. Thanks very much indeed for making time to speak to us. Josh Gilbert there, market analyst at eToro, joining us on the line from Sydney, Australia.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast.
WEO Bank, a bank that was the subject of much discussion last year, and you don't say that about many financial institutions, has become profitable in its first year of operations. Very pleased to be joined by Jayesh Patel, who is the CEO of the digital bank WEO Bank. It's lovely to see you, Jayesh. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So we've got your first full year numbers here. Obviously, we don't have anything to compare it to. This is the first lot you've put out there. But we've got revenue of 266 million dirhams, 2 million dirhams in net profit. How does that compare with your own expectations?
Look, we've had a fantastic year. A big thanks to all the customers who've trusted us and given us the opportunity to serve them. We've grown rapidly, faster than we thought. We grow, 4 out of 5 of our customers come from referrals from other customers. So we've had a really, really good year and well ahead of our initial plan.
You don't have to give us your numbers. Why have you chosen to do so?
I think we have some disclosures we have to make on our website, which is important. But I think it's great for customers to know how we're doing. They're trusting us with their money. They hear our name and our brand. I think it's important they know how we're doing.
Right. So we've got deposits of 11 billion here in that first year, 90,000 customers between business and personal. WeHo Bank was the subject of much water cooler conversation last year because you were offering interest rates on deposits that were higher than the base rate and higher than what was generally being offered around town. I'm looking at a headline from October the 4th, 2023, offering 6% interest on savings. It got people talking. Why did you do that?
I think, look, we want to focus on making sure our customers get value from whatever they do. We want to help our customers achieve more of their goals. And one of the ways we are doing it is trying to see where can we offer more. Yeah, I thought 6%, we're in a high interest rate environment. I thought that would be incredibly beneficial to the customers. And it was a great launch offer for customers. It has done fairly well for us.
How much would you say, if you were to put a rough percentage of it, of your personal customers came because of that offer?
You know, I'll tell you, the way we look at it, a lot of customers join us because of the attractive offer we have. But I think a lot of them experience our app. They see the transparency, the features that help them. And a lot of them use a lot of our features because of the experience they get in the application.
Oh, I'm sure they then stay, Jayesh. But if you were to put a rough number on it, do you think it was good for about 20%? What do you reckon?
It's hard to say. I would assume at the start, more came for the offer. I think as time went by and our brand and our app reputation went out, I think less for the offer.
Okay. So how do you then manage expectations going forward? I'm on the WeHo website at the moment, and we're down to 5% per annum on your savings. There are lots of little asterisks on this, by the way, and 5.5% for your fixed savings. You can't stay at the high rate forever. How do you keep people happy then?
No, so look, I think our approach at WeHo is we want to make sure the customers get the best value. Sometimes we'll be able to offer more. Sometimes we'll be able to offer less. I think as interest rates change, we'll have to make adjustments. But we promise you, we're committed to making sure customers get the maximum.
And how do you pay for that? What are you charging for the people you're lending money to?
So we're just beginning to lend. We have a credit card out for consumers, I think, which is the most simple and transparent credit card in the market. We're beginning to experiment with the SME credit cards. We had our first ones out in beta this week. And SME loans, we're going to start working credit for SME. So as we grow this, we will start lending to customers and we'll make revenues off of that. Right now, we invest in treasuries and that helps us offset the balance that we give our customers.
Now, I know you've spoken to Tom here quite a bit about the SME market and about making it simple for people to open up. Out of the 50,000 businesses that you've got, what's the average size of those companies? Is it the smaller, the startup that you're picking up there?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, smaller businesses have struggled to open accounts in the UAE, and we wanted to solve this because I think they're the backbone of the economy. When we started out, we started with the smaller SMEs. I think over the past year, we've grown. So now you can add accountants to the platform. You could add multiple partners. And now we are seeing larger companies move to us. About a third of the companies we open up are new to the country, so formed in the last 12 months. So we have a large spread of customers. Now we have the large SMEs and some of the corporates beginning to bank with us. And we have the smaller startup SMEs, which is really exciting.
What about on the personal front? What percentage of those are new to the country?
So on the personal front, it's slightly less. It's about 20% who are new to the country. Three quarters of the customers have been in the UAE and have multiple accounts. They're moving to us because of the offer and the experience.
Are they moving their main account, their salary transfer account, to you?
You know, it's surprisingly, we're seeing a lot more customers move salary transfer accounts to us. They start with us, they experience us, and then in a few months, we are beginning to start seeing a shift of salary accounts moving to us.
And who are the personal customers who are starting up with you? Digital bank might be an assumption that it's the younger customer. Is that true?
It's not true. I think it's digital has become a foundation. Everyone uses digital. Yeah, I think the ease of use of our app and some of the products we have are driving customer segments across the board. Yeah, so we have all age groups, all income levels moving to us.
Okay, so what's the target? If you and I sit here a year from now, what do you want to be able to tell me about your customer numbers on both the business and the personal?
Look, I think we want to grow rapidly. We want to serve as many businesses as we can. If I look longer term, we definitely want to be the number one bank serving businesses. When it comes to consumers, in the next few years, we would like to be the top three banks serving consumers in the UAE and maybe expand to other markets.
What kind of other markets?
I think it falls where we can add value, yeah, and our product and our proposition makes a lot more sense. Those are the markets we'll go to. Regional is the obvious expansion route, but there are many places where we believe our service would be incredibly competitive.
Name me some countries.
I think we are in exploration stage. I think the usual suspects would come up. Yeah, I think our neighboring GCC countries would definitely be of core interest. Maybe North Africa, maybe parts of Asia where we think we can add a lot more value.
Saudi,
absolutely. It's a great market.
40 seconds left with you. You've got some interesting backers, Fab Bank, Abu Dhabi Holding. Is there any talk about you eventually going public, offering some shares?
Yeah, you look, eventually, like every big company, we would like to do that. I think we have a lot of growth left. We have a lot to do yet till we get there, and I think at the right time, we'll do it.
Has the discussion been had around the boardroom, though, as a goal at some point?
I think our focus right now is serving our customers, continue to build the great franchise that's being built, and at the right time, we'll have that conversation.
Jayesh Patel is the CEO of WEO Bank, coming out with their first ever numbers for their first full years of operations, 11 billion in deposits, 10 million in net profit, and over 90,000 customers when it comes to both business and personal. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast.
Right, let's talk about the World Economic Forum, because this week, this is the story in the Financial Times. Klaus Schwab, the 86-year-old founder of the World Economic Forum, is to resign as its executive chair after more than half a century at the helm of the world's preeminent business conference. He will step back in January and assume a new role as chair of the World Economic Forum's Board of Trustees. Joining us in the studio to discuss this is someone who knows him better than most. Fred Secret was for many years the managing director of the World Economic Forum. He's been based in Dubai for the past decade or so, and he's with us live in the studio. Fred, good morning. Thanks very much indeed for being with us.
Good morning. Richard.
Currently on your business card, it says managing partner of TARDIS Advisors. Just found out that you were a DJ in France for 3 years previously.
That was a long time ago. Long time ago.
Well, more of that perhaps on another occasion. But let's talk about Klaus Schwab now. So you and I chatted last night and you said to me, he's not retiring. He's just moving aside a little bit, but he's still sticking around. We'll dig into that in a second. But let's hear from him now. Klaus Schwab. This is him. Perhaps his most famous recent speech was about the fourth industrial revolution, the phrase that he coined almost a decade ago now with a book and a speech. This is him talking about it actually in Dubai in 2016. This is Klaus Schwab.
When I was here last year, I talked about innovation, and many of the things I talked about were considered to be fiction, far away in the future. But ladies and gentlemen, excellencies, the future is already here. Let me tell you why this fourth industrial revolution is so crucial, so overwhelming in terms of the changes it will bring to us.
He's a tough act to follow, Fred, isn't he?
Yeah, he, well, you know, not everybody creates an organization like the World Economic Forum and makes it last for throughout more than five decades.
And I would argue that a big part of it has been the force of his personality, his intellect, but also his magnetic charisma. And people do joke, you know, he's the best Bond baddie that the James Bond franchise never had, because he's got that gravitas. And him personally has been a, not the only part of its success, but a big part of its success. And as we move towards succession and transition, he's not completely going away, but we're clearly moving in that direction. What happens next?
Well, I think it's clear that he is, as you said, not leaving. It's a natural evolution of an organization. He's 86 years old. I was with him a few months ago. He's in great shape. I think he's come to the point now where he realizes that at the age of 86, he can't be popping all over the planet and running a huge organization. And he's come to terms and come to comfort, more importantly, with the management team that is in place and with Borge Brende, the current president, that's been in place now for a number of years. So he's going to be able to now sit with the board of trustees, who are really the ones who guide the strategy of the World Economic Forum. That's what he has done most of his life, is define the strategy, and he's helped execute it. Now he's got an execution team in place, and he's going to continue focusing on the strategy.
And it was interesting to me that at the World Economic Forum meeting in Riyadh a few weeks ago, the first formal WEF meeting in Riyadh, it was Borge Brende who was front and center, not Klaus Schwab in person.
Yeah, I mean, and again, natural evolution, and that's, you could have seen that already a year ago at COP, or 2 years ago. It was Borge Brende who, with John Kerry, launched the first Movers Coalition. It was not Klaus. So there's the future of the forum, which was your question, is I think it's been able to transition from being a conference organization over the years into an organization that really develops public-private partnerships, because it doesn't work just with CEOs anymore. It works with chief technology officers. It works with chief research officers. It works with the whole gamut of the C-suite of big, large corporations to try and advance issues. So it's a bit like the IMF World Bank. They have their annual meeting in Washington, but there's work. It's not what defines the IMF or the World Bank. Davos no longer really defines what the World Economic Forum is. It's just the annual meeting. The work that happens throughout the year is what defines the forum.
And yet, I think there's a rock star charisma around Klaus Schwab that, and it's my thesis, I'm not saying you have to agree with me, that I think they have to replace. And I'm not sure Borge Brende is it. Former Norwegian finance minister and a fine man, no question at all. But he's not going to fill the... He's not going to fill Mandanat Conference Center at the World Government Summit in the way that Klaus Schwab does. And my thesis is that the World Economic Forum needs someone with a bit more magnetism, charisma, a bit more star quality. You could disagree with me.
I'll say two things. First of all, Borge Brende doesn't have 50 years behind him of having built his profile and reputation the way Klaus has. If you look at the board of trustees that the World Economic Forum has, you have from this region, Lubna Olayan, you have Queen Rania, but you have the CEOs of Nestle, of big, large corporations, former political leaders. Many of those could, if need be, step in, like Christine Lagarde, like Tony Blair could step in. But right now, there's no need for that.
So Christine Lagarde was one of the names I had in mind. And I've played the parlor game of, well, who would I like to see replace him? Who could stride the world stage with that magnetism? And I came up with, Christine Lagarde was on my shortlist, but I plumped for this guy instead. And you've got your headphones on, so you can hear this. It's the Indian politician Shashi Tharoor, who's a regular in Dubai, a fantastic speaker, long time number two at the United Nations as well. So he's got that international experience as well. Have a listen to this. This is a speech of his a few years ago, speaking actually at Oxford University in London, talking about economics, talking about the impact of British rule in India many years ago. This is Shashi Tharoor.
India's share of the world economy when Britain arrived on its shores was 23%. By the time the British left, it was down to below 4%. Meanwhile, colonialists like Robert Clive bought their rotten boroughs in England on the proceeds of their loot in India, while taking the Hindi word loot into their dictionaries as well as their habits. And the British had the gall to call him Clive of India, as if he belonged to the country, when all he really did was to ensure that much of the country belonged to him.
Look, I've never heard Klaus speak like that. I've got to tell you something, Richard. You said that he is charismatic. I've got to tell you that Klaus Schwab is actually socially awkward. And it is a very strange thing that a man who has a certain introvertness created a huge machinery that makes world leaders meet with one another. He's not the most charismatic person in the world.
It's a fair point. But one left field choice I had, and I was reading this on the World Economic Forum website, and this was published on the 25th anniversary of the World Economic Forum. So this is, you know, 2.5 decades ago. And it says, one of the first things that Schwab did was to choose a 26-year-old executive, send him in 1990 to South Africa carrying 40 kilograms of World Economic Forum literature and told him to find tomorrow's leaders. His charm, smile, boundless energy built a network of trust and enthusiasm. You're smiling because you know who I'm referring to. That was you, 28-year-old Fred Secre back then.
Yeah, that's right. He's a professor at heart, and the way he created the forum was to give young people an opportunity that you would never otherwise get. So that's the first challenge he gave to me, and I ended up working with Nelson Mandela for many years on the transition to South Africa. Yeah,
Fred, really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much indeed. And next time you come, we're going to get some decks out. We'll get you DJing again.
Let's do it.
Fred Secre there joining us, former managing director of the World Economic Forum, currently managing partner of TARDIS Advisors.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.